Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
I think I'm going to move further into the steps now, and a basic two-second overview is that for me, I had to build a foundation in steps 1, 2, and 3, and that came with looking at the unmanageable life and the ego and the compliance and the surrender, and then seeing that it's not just about the drinking, that alcoholism is not in the liquid, it's alive and functioning right now, and it needs to be treated. It's an ism, it's not a wisdom. And going into step 2, and how do I come to believe that there's a power that can restore me to sanity, and using other literature like the Sermon on the Mount by the Fox has been very helpful for me. And then going into step 3, when I make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of this power, as I understood him, it says past tense, so I understood because I had a relationship in step 2 and I had an experience. And in step 3, I realized that I can never completely understand God. It's just understood because God is so infinite. And, you know, in the big book, it's very clear that it talks about now we're at step 3, and many of us said, you know, God, I offer myself to thee to deal with me and to do with me as thou will. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties and victory over them. Make your witness to those that would help, that power that I love, and I may have like. And do thy will always. And in the book, the clear instruction is that we thought well before taking the step, making sure we were ready, and that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to God. And the willingness to be rid of self is the important factor.
Whether self completely goes or not is all up to God. I don't know what's going to happen in the end. I don't know if defects get lifted. I don't know what gets lifted. But that I continue to be willing. And when I look at my will in my life are my thoughts and my actions. That's what I learned here. So my will is my thinking and my thought is my will in my life are my thinkings and my actions. My will is my thoughts and my life is my actions. How I treat other people, what I decide to say, what I decide not to say. And as I make a decision to turn my will in my life, if I don't have the willingness, I can definitely pray for the willingness. When I see a sponsee that appears to be unwilling or somebody that I'm working with appears to be unwilling, a definite suggestion that I'll give is pray for the willingness. Ask God to keep you willing. Ask God to help you be more willing when you're holding on to a defect that you know you should let go of. Ask God to help you be more self-honest, more willing in the moment. And like I said, it's a lifelong process. And so once that foundation in step 3 is formed pretty well, it's much easier to go into step 4. And in step 4, when I make a fearless and moral searching inventory of self, it's fearless because I have a power today. If I didn't have a power, it would be fearful. That's why I feel it's very important that this isn't a race, because I've often seen young people or new people come into AA and just get a fourth step dumped on them, and it's too much to bear. They go running the other way. And so I feel that it is a lifelong journey, and I don't know when. I just know that some people, you can clearly see that now you're ready for a fourth step and others aren't. And I don't force anything upon anybody. You can tell an alcoholic something, but you can't tell them much, you know, whatever that saying is. I can't force anything on anyone anyway. Usually the God inside is ready enough, and the sponsee or the alcoholic is ripe enough that they're really ready to go the extra mile. You know, the mystics would talk about the willingness to be with God in the end is the free and the undeserved gift also, that I'm not even doing the willingness, that self can't be willing enough to be with God, that something else has to be taking its place or I wouldn't be willing. So even my willingness to show up here and to do this and to be a humble servant for God is not my will anymore. God's doing the work. I'm not. I'm emptying my vessel out and I'm allowing God to maneuver through me. in the steps, as I go into the fourth step process, I really like, as outlined in the big book, and I like the structure of the fourth step exactly as outlined. And there's several reasons why. I've definitely done other inventories, you know, ditto cheat Xerox things, the California childhood inventory, do it this way, do it that way. And there's one or two reasons why I feel that it's so important that I do it as outlined. It's because I can hand down a lineage that's been handed down through 76 years from Bill Wilson all the way to us. And then it's foolproof. So there's no argument. Is it AA or is it not AA? And so this last time around, I just completed a fourth and a fifth and I'm in my amend step. I did it as outlined in the big book. And this guy from as outlined in the big book down in LA, Sheldon Wolf, took me through the big book and I had to write everything out. All my columns, all my everything. I had to get a ruler and get a yellow piece of paper. And so basically my experience was I wrote down all the names just like we're supposed to. And I didn't have a lot this time. I had 23. You know, I don't know about this rummaging in and getting into the hundreds and hundreds of them. Sometimes it gets so overwhelming. In the book, it says, The things that really burned me up. So we were sore. We were burned up. If it's not burning me up anymore, I don't know what the point is of inventorying it. It's the things that I'm really have an inner trigger and an inner struggle with that I want to put down on paper. And again, it's not about the, quantity. It's about the quality. It's about the content. I believe that I can do a fourth step on two or three resentments or one resentment just as well as I can do a full inventory because I haven't done one for several years. So the key is in the willingness and the thoroughness, and there's no finishing point and there's no perfect way to do it. But this time I had 23 resentments. I wrote the names down and then I did the columns where on the front I got, he told me to get a yellow lined paper. This is exactly how I did it. I wrote the name in that first column. I wrote the cause or the resentment in that second column. And then over here, how it affects and exactly as outlined in the big book. My self-esteem, my security, my ambition, my personal relations, my sex relations, and my pocketbook. And I did this to the best of my ability. The thing that I love about this last sponsor that took me through the book is that he wanted me to really get in touch with like how angry I was. So, you know, yeah, I had this one sponsor for a minute and she tried to push all this Landmark Forum stuff on me and I got really, really upset about it. So she's one of the things that's on my resentment list. Not to have anything against Landmark Forum, but it's just like, I feel like there's no place in Alcoholics Anonymous for that. And so I felt like really duped after I got sucked in. She reeled me in to AA and then she started to push this other stuff on me and then I got rid of her and I fired her. And so he said, I want you to really get in touch with the anger. And so when I started writing the resentments, I said something like, well, I don't feel it's appropriate. It's like, no. I want you to get in touch with really how it affects your self-esteem. You know, and it's like, I am the queen of AA and you're threatening me and you shouldn't even be in my frickin' meeting and off with your head and you need to die. How does it affect my security? You better apologize to me or get the heck out of here. Like he really wanted me to get in touch with the core nastiness of what the ego is attached to. You know, my ambition, get out. It says, get the F out is what I put in there. You know, my sex relations. Women in recovery are so damaged. Women should help each other. They should have each other's back. So I go into the harm with fury. I don't, you know, there's two ways I've heard to do it. One is it is a subjective view and one is an objective view. I do feel that if I'm just looking from a bird's eye view up here, then I don't know if I'm diving all the way down into the subconscious mind. The point of the inventory itself is to get in touch with the pain and the anger and the hostility. I actually really like when I see somebody that's in a four step and they're crying and they're retching and they're all disconnected because they're having an experience with the step itself. If I'm not having an experience with the step, then I'm in homework again. And how many times have I been self-deceived? So this particular inventory that I did, I feel was very thorough and I felt sick a lot and I felt uneasy and I kept thinking, is this going to be lifted? Is this not going to be lifted? You know, how are these resentments going to go? And my sponsor, who really is a black belt, especially in 4 and 5, he would say the same thing to me over and over. He'd say, don't look at me. I'm not God. I don't know what's going to be lifted and not lifted. I'm not guaranteeing you anything. You're the one doing the work. I'm just the sponsor. And I really like that answer, because so often it's like, oh, there. You're going to be fine. You're going to be okay. And they're not always okay. So I don't want to make an unreasonable promise that's not going to be met. I don't know what the outcome is for anyone, and I don't know what the outcome is for myself. Some of these things are lifted. Some of these things are not lifted. Some of these things are lighter. Some of these things need constant improvement and constant prayer. But the point is that I get these resentments out on paper, and then I do that last column on the back, and with every single resentment I wrote on the back side of the resentment, God, this is a sick woman, or God, this is a sick man like myself. How can I be helpful? Save me from being angry. Thy will, not mine, be done. Just like it says in the book. So I write that prayer for every single person. Every single solitary person gets that. Besides, this is also not about penmanship or spelling. We don't care if you scribble or write with your feet or whatever. Crayons, it doesn't matter. This isn't about some kind of perfect, you know, yeah. So, and then again on the back, so where had I been selfish? Where had I been selfish? I think I know what's best for AA meetings. I think I'm the one that needs to make it clear. I expect people to treat me a certain way. Where was I dishonest? I expect to have things my way. That's dishonest. I expect people to be different. I have unrealistic expectations of severely mentally ill people. It's dishonest of me. It's ridiculously dishonest of me. You know, it's one thing to have an expectation of my own fourth step and my work, but to expect anyone else to be or show up or behave or act or wear a hat in a certain way is always a major setup for failure. So even my sponsor is going to fail me. I'm going to look cockeyed at anyone and everyone. This woman was doing the very best she could. Is landmark form a bad thing? I don't think so, but I'm not interested in it. Did she think she was doing the right thing? She absolutely thought she was doing the right thing. She really thought she was going to help me by taking me to a self-help program. I don't want self-help. I want God help. Just a difference of opinion. I don't need to slit her throat and throw her away, but that's what self wanted to do, because AA needs to be a certain way and you can't do this and blah, blah, blah. And I could have just held my ground and said, you know, the traditions are that that's an outside issue and I just don't think that it's conducive for this, and I could have been done with it. But oh no, self grabbed a hold of it, the ego grabbed a hold of it, and yeah, my head spun around and green stuff went flying out, daggers everywhere. And this poor woman who didn't really even wrong me, but I made up this big story in my head of how sponsorship should be and how the structure of it should be and what you should be presenting and blah, 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 blah. And I pour my own Dixie cup of cyanide and I drink it and I throw up, you know, round and around and around it goes. You know, where was I afraid or frightened? I thought she would harm me. She would harm other people, you know. And so it's that I get down to the core of whatever's going on in here at the deepest, darkest level. I want to really, really, really see what self looks like. I don't want to spritz perfume on this stuff. I don't want to make light of it. I want to get down into the dirty, you know. And after that, I do my sex inventory and my fear inventory. And sex inventory, again, is not about penis and vagina. You know, it says in here that that's an outside issue, like how it all went down. What we're inventorying here is how I've treated the opposite sex. That's exactly what I'm looking at. I'm not looking at who had an orgasm or used a condom. It has nothing to do with that at all. It's like, how repeatedly over and over again have I expected you to take care of me? And when you fall short, I snip your nuts nuts off, turn you into a mouse and watch you squeak away and then say, see, they're all like that. Because I don't know how to nurture a man, and I don't know how to respect him, and I don't know how to treat him like a man should be treated. I don't know how to have a healthy interaction. I have these unreasonable demands, these unrealistic expectations, and when they don't come to fruition, I'm incredibly cruel and mean. One of my biggest defects is I am mean. I'm so mean. And I have laser radar on how to hurt you. I take stock and I put it in my Rolodex and I know what the harms are. And then bam, when I'm ready, here comes the BB gun and the darts and everything else. I'm cruel inside. Very, very cruel when I don't get my way. And my past becomes my future. So we look at these. I think they're 9 things. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There are 9 things it says in the sex inventory. It says, where was I selfish? Where was I dishonest? Where was I inconsiderate? Who did I hurt? Did I arouse jealousy? Did I arouse suspicion? Where was I at fault? Did I create bitterness? What should I have done differently? Again, these are like one sentence answers. This is not writing a novel. It's just basically going back and getting a little history on it. I first start on the backside and I write a little story about the guy. You know, I met him in a bar on a vacation in the Florida Keys, blah, 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 blah. My second DUI. Yeah. You know, where was I selfish? I wanted him to love me, and I was disconnected, and he was disconnected. I wanted to be totally cherished and treated like a queen. Yet I didn't treat my man like a king. I didn't have respect for him. I was demanding and pushing and shoving. That's completely dishonest. I wanted something for nothing. I couldn't be the woman that God wanted me to be, and yet you better treat me a certain way. You know, where was I dishonest? I was hooked on drugs. I was stealing. I was lying. I wasn't coming home at night. You know, where was I inconsiderate? I wouldn't call. I would always yell at him. You don't love me. You don't treat me right. You know, who did I hurt? I hurt him. I hurt his whole family. You know, did I arouse jealousy? I'm sure I did. You know, did I arouse suspicion? I'm sure I did. Where was I at fault? I was high from the beginning. My picker was broken. I had no capacity to even enter into a healthy relationship. I'm at fault all the way in most of these situations. There isn't even a bit that's on their side of the street. It's all of my stuff. It's not very often that you find that they're 95% wrong and I'm 1% wrong. Most of the time I'm 95 to 98% wrong. Sometimes people are really victimized and that's a whole different category. And I actually have some opinions on that real quick here. You know, some people have been abused and like real harms, like beaten, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, that kind of stuff. And I can tell you that, this is just an opinion. I don't believe in ever sending a sponsee back into the perpetrator's arena and telling them, I am sorry for hating you after you repeatedly abused me as a child and took my virginity and blah, 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 blah. Some of these harms are so horrifying and so disgusting, but there are ways to lift it. There are ways to look at those people and to have compassion and to do something for others that are harmed in that arena. But I don't know that one shoe fits all. And I don't even know that Bill was in touch with how severe some of these harms could be. I don't even know when this was all written, if he ever took into consideration some of the major atrocities, and they're not very often. Most of the time an alcoholic will try to justify a resentment. It's like, uh-uh. But every once in a while, there is something that's so deep and so dark that there's just no way that there's even an apology that's supposed to be involved here. So each resentment needs to be taken into great consideration because it's not above the board. Okay, man, put them on your list, you know, write out that little, man, do your night step thing or you're never going to be free and you're probably going to drink again. I don't believe in that whole concept of if I don't make all my amends, I will drink again. I don't believe that at all. Some amends aren't ever going to get made. Some things are lightened. Some things get completely lifted. Some things are living amends. I don't know. This is between me and my God, not between me and my sponsees. Not between me and my sponsor, not between me and my family members. It's me getting right inside my heart with my Creator. That's the most important part. I'm not here to to impress anybody. And even if on the outside people are like, man, you know, she or he needs to clean that up. If they say they cleaned it up inside, then they say they cleaned it up inside. I leave it. I don't have an outside opinion on somebody else's stuff that way. So, you know, did I cause bitterness? You know, his family hated me. But, you know, often in the column of what should I have done instead, my sponsor guided me in the direction of using my mind the way it is today, not then. Because often the what should I have done instead in the sex inventory is, I couldn't have done anything differently because I was operating from self. But what should I have done differently? You know, I should have gotten a therapist. I should have gone to AA. I should have hung out with people my own age. So on that column, I often talk about something that's logical, like a mind function and a mindset that I can come from today. And in my fear inventory, I only had, I think, about 9 or 10, you know, fears. And, you know, hepatitis C. I'm afraid of my landlord raising my rent. I'm afraid of that I'm going to get cancer. You know, I'm afraid of my sister yelling at me or rejecting me. And then, you know, why do I have this fear? You know, it stirs something inside of my instincts for security and survival. You know, did self-will fail me every single time? Yeah, holding on to it does nothing. And then, God, please remove this fear and direct my attention for what you would have me do. You know, and what good would God have me do? And I write a little thing about what God would have me do. You know, I'm afraid of cancer. I think God would have me drink a lot of water and take vitamin C and eat more salads. And my sponsor goes, that's not the answer. The answer is trust in God completely no matter what you eat and what you do. You know, and I thought, well, that's a really interesting one. You know, he took it a mile further. I still sort of somewhere in there think the more I take care of myself, the more I won't ever get a cancer. But, you know, there probably is a lot of self-will even in that sentence. So everything's not like clear across the board. You know, it's not like this perfect thing. Anyway, as I go into my fear inventory and the sex inventory and, you know, and then I do a step 5. And for me, the most important thing in my step 5 is that I'm really, really willing to have this stuff removed. My sponsor can't remove anything. Whether he's fidgeting while he's listening to me or he's wholeheartedly listening, I want to have an experience. So I want to be so connected to those resentments as I'm reading them. Like, I even want to have a cathartic crying if it's possible to be getting in touch with emotion. I don't want to be reading it from the intellect. This is the time to go into the past and rummage around and begin to vomit. Really vomit. There's so many times when you shouldn't have been fiddling in there and you were, and now here's your chance to do it. Now come on, muscle up and get that poop all over you. Let's go. Let's get it out from the subconscious out to a conscious level and make a conscious effort that I'm really going to be done of this. I'm really, really, really going to ask God to change my thinking, direct my thoughts, free this person. And if there's a harm done, make amends in step 9. So there's so much to be considered here. And I feel like what I'm giving you right now is exactly as outlined in the big book. So there's not a whole lot of room for argument. And I did not have this 2 years ago. Like the verbiage that I'm using today and the demonstration that I'm using today was really given to me by a heavy hitter AA sponsor of like, this is it. And like I said just a few minutes ago, the reason why is because I've just seen a lot of argument and a lot of problem with 4 steps and people have a struggle getting through. And so for me, I've bought this package and this is it, hook, line, and sinker. This is the way I'm going to live it. This is the way I'm going to present it. This is the way I'm going to inventory it. This is what's in the book. And I don't want to waver from this. Are there any questions or would somebody like to share on their process? Somebody have something to share with us? Nothing. I scare them so quietly. It's a lot of information. Okay, so 6 and 7. An overview of step 6 and step 7 for me. This is what I learned is that step 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove my defects. And step 7, humbly ask him to remove my shortcomings. 6 and 7 are like night and day. 6, my defects is that I'm doing things that I have no business doing, and shortcomings are things that I should be doing that I'm still not doing. So the first six steps are to remove the old character, and the next six steps are for the new character to be the new woman, to walk in the sunlight with God. So there's been a tremendous amount of excavation and digging and rearranging and putting on new glasses and getting new thoughts and new concepts and new ideas. And again, this is a lifelong process. But those first six steps, if done thoroughly, I should be having a real experience now. People can see something's changed. Wow, you know, that woman's in AA and she's doing the deal, and I can tell she's happier, she's freer, she's not cussing so much, she's not hating, it doesn't even seem like she's mad about, you know, the blah, 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 blah. And I start to have a real inward experience. When I look at my defects and I ask God to remove them, sometimes quickly and sometimes slowly, but what we're looking for is that constant improvement. Is that there is improvement, even if it's just small improvement. Let's just say it's, I don't know, anything from the shopping to the porn to the eating to the cussing to the hating to the whatever, that I can check my track record. I can see 6 months ago, it was definitely worse than it is now, you know, because these defects are what are ceaselessly going to devour the foundation for a new life today, and they're going to take me out of the game. And self might tell me something like, God, this stuff's never going to go away. I'm always going to be muscling up and arguing and wrestling with my lower nature and these character defects. But if I really get self-honest and I look, there probably is a way to detect that there has been improvement. And that's all I'm looking for. And again, sometimes quickly and sometimes slowly. In step seven, where I have shortcomings and I'm coming up short, you know, humility is in the 12 and 12, it talks about it's the desire to seek and do God's will. And again, each step is there designed to get me closer and closer and closer to God. And in step seven, most of the time, naturally, I start to become a giver. All by itself, it starts to unfold. I'm more patient. I'm more generous. I'm kinder. I look at people that used to really disturb me or trigger me, and there's just nothing there anymore. Or I actually can feel some real love or real compassion for a fellow where there was just nothing going on before, nothing but frustration or hatred, you know, and going the extra mile, you know, like I said earlier, when there's abundance in my life, that I can really help other people, you know, that I'm willing to really be of service, you know, maybe even in an outside issue in AA, you know, help somebody in a way that's not AA-like. And so often we'll see people come into the rooms that just have so much more problems than alcoholism. I mean, they're really tore up, messed up, mentally defective. You know, and my first instinct would be like, oh, my God, run. I don't even want to, you know, some of them just by the look of them, they drain you. It's like, oh, yo, 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 yo. And God helps me in step seven be much more patient with those people, with the hardest cases, with the ones that nobody wants to help, nobody even wants to sit next to, nobody wants to be around. And I clearly start to see like, wow, you know, my shortcomings are opening up. I'm not coming up short. I am going further in the application. I am going further in the day. I'm starting to do things I never would have done before. I'm starting to behave in a way that's so miraculous. And even the way I treated somebody in a good way last year, I've gone even further this year. I can definitely feel that my love and my compassion for my fellows is opening up more and more and more as I go deeper into the steps and I go further into the spiritual life with God and the 12 steps. And so, like I said before, it's constant improvement and it's looking for improvement, but I really want to see that, what am I still resisting as far as the human race? You know, who am I still not forgiving? And sometimes it's so subtle, like I could even think that a resentment's been lifted, but I'll see how I'll dodge a certain person. I'll just feel that reaction. I'll feel that knee-jerk thing. And I'll just stop and pause for a minute, like, wow, I thought that was gone. You know, God, help me. Help me with my eye contact. Help me with my body language. Help that not be there. Those subtleties And the awareness of those subtleties are so important for me to keep checking my track record, to keep taking my temperature on a moment by moment basis, to keep growing and growing and growing towards the sunlight. Who would like to share? Would somebody like to share on one of these later steps, the fourth step or the fifth step, or any experience or a question? Right back there. Come on up.
I'm an alcoholic named Bill.
Hi, Bill.
Astrid, last night you were talking about transcending versus aligning my will with God's will. And then you were talking a little bit about that this morning, too. And I relate that especially to step 6 and 7. And I'm wondering if you could talk again about the difference, because to me, step 6 is cooperating with God, and step 7 is asking to have stuff removed that I can't do on my own. And I don't know whether that's transcending, like jumping over something, or whether that's trying to change direction in a line.
Right. Well, we want to get back into the instincts of sex, security, and my desire to be someone in society. And those instincts are God-given. So they're part of my wired nature, but they far exceed their intended purpose with the average alcoholic. So like it says in the literature, I'm always grabbing for more and wanting more. And the proper use of my will, part of that proper use is to bring those instincts in alignment with God's will. So that fine line between need and greed, how those instincts get spurred is, you know, I gave this analogy earlier, and I'm going to give this to somebody earlier. I'm going to give this analogy again, okay? Follow me here. Let's just hypothetically say that me and you and somebody else are in the room, and then this person walks in with birthday invitations, and they give that guy one and me one, and they don't give you anything, okay? And you feel immediately that, okay, before there's even a story in the mind, the ego and its sense for security and its desire to be someone in society gets triggered. Now, I'm up on my muscle, and I instantly start to have a self-talk. So the instinct for my security and my ego get triggered, and now I start self-talking. Oh, really? Oh, is that so? And then I go flying off into a character defect, and I just snub the person, and I treat them badly. And then I go out to lunch with my friends, and I'm an a-hole, and I'm completely disconnected. So I want to bring those instincts into alignment with God's will for me. So the instinct for security, I want to be in with God's alignment. So when somebody else gets picked and I don't get picked, or someone gets invited and I don't get invited, God, please help me stay in humility. I don't need to be looked at or picked or treated a certain way. I can be okay in the moment that I'm in. The other aspect is just to, you know, in daily life, so much gets thrown at us. We have paychecks. Many of us we're in relationships. We have wives, husbands, cars, bank accounts, blah, 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 blah. And those things need to be looked at and balanced very carefully. So how do I bring balance into my life in any of those areas is one question. And then another question is, what can I look at that actually I could just transcend? I could just hop over and get rid of all of this. So each individual thing needs to be taken into great consideration, and then your truth and my truth are going to be different. I don't desire to ever own property again. I don't even know if I'll ever be in a relationship again. I haven't been in one, and I'm not looking for a mate. You might be on Match.com looking and looking because a wife is really important to you. So I would say, I've hopped out and I've hopped up because God's helped me to do that, and I'm completely done with that instinct. Like, I don't desire to be in a relationship. But how can you be searching for a mate and have an open mind and not have this repetitive urgency? Like, hey man, do you know anyone that you can set me up with? And God, I've been on the computer all night, and I've been on 8 dates and all these bitches and witches and blah, 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 blah. You know? Like, you can allow yourself to unfold and allow somebody to come into your life. So where is the urgency and where is the open space to be receptive? And then on the other path, where is it been completely transcended and that particular aspect of the instinct isn't even there anymore? It's not even there. So I know this is a lot of information and it might get real tricky for you guys to follow, but it's definitely two different things. And each of them have to be considered. You know, there are people that really, really want a summer home and a winter home. And there's nothing wrong with wanting that at all. So how are we going to be bi-coastal? How are we going to have two houses? And what's the fine line between need and greed? And is this God's will for us? And do we have enough money to do this? Or am I pushing and shoving and borrowing and scrimping and saving to try to make this thing happen? And if it doesn't happen, I'm going to go crazy because I have a mental movie of how my future's supposed to be. So if I bring that instinct into alignment with God's will and I keep focusing on this is what I'd really like and if it's your will for me, God, could you help me achieve this? It'll either be achieved or it won't be achieved. I don't have the desire to be bi-coastal or own two homes. So I've transcended even ever owning property. That idea isn't there for me. So I have left less to spin out on. The path that God's put me on is often very different from a lot of people's paths. They would rather bring their instincts into alignment with God's will. I would prefer to transcend them. And that's just the way God's called me. It's very easy for me to just throw it all away. I don't need it. Take it. You know, you want to argue over whatever, the ring, the family jewelry, the this, the, take it, have it all. It's okay. No problem. And I really feel good in that area. So like I said, each individual thing needs to be considered and looked at very carefully and then getting self-honest and seeing is there an urgency in there and then bringing those instincts into balance with God's will. I hope I was helpful with that. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Mary and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Marianne.
Hi, Astrid. Thank you so much for being here. My question comes from the reacting, responding, pausing, you know, getting to that point where there's actually a second of time of reflection, you know, before I react, because that, you know, that's what my ego does. My ego reacts. You know, and it, I have to react first before I can say, oh, wait a minute, I'm reacting. You know, I'd like to tell you to talk a little bit about that pause, that moment of reflection, that space, maybe
right.
How to give that to myself.
Yeah. You know, well, in step 10 on, I think it's on page 90. It's somewhere in here where it's a spiritual axiom that anytime I'm disturbed, no matter what, page 90, it's a spiritual axiom that every time I'm disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with me and it's my ego. That's what's wrong with me. And, so if somebody hurts me and I'm sore, I am in the wrong also. But are there no exceptions to this rule? What about justifiable anger? If somebody cheats me, aren't I entitled to be mad? Can't I be properly angry with self-righteous folk? For us of AA, these are dangerous exceptions. We have found that justified anger ought to be left to those better qualified to handle it. So there's the principle. You know, Bill's saying that anytime I'm disturbed, anytime I'm triggered, there's something wrong with me. No matter how severely I'm triggered, there's something wrong. Now, there is a little cheating window I'm going to give you, okay? Sometimes what's wrong with me is something is so damn unacceptable that I got to get the hell out of here. Sometimes the situation is so, you bet there's something wrong with me, and I can't accept that this situation is so unacceptable. So instead of fighting and resisting and trying to plant myself there, I move the other way. But the question was how not to take the bait. So I wake up and I start to really watch the mind function and I start to notice my inner stirrings. And the minute I have a knee-jerk reaction to anything, I'm awake. I'm like, whoa, what was that? What was that? And I back down and I say, God, can you please protect me from my mind? Because I'm just about to go into alcoholism. And when I back down, it allows for the space of grace to come in. That's the proper use of my will, is to practice the restraint of pen and tongue, or to pause when doubtful or agitated, to learn how to press the pause button. That is the absolute perfect use of my will, is to back down and allow for a space of, oh my gosh, I'm about to get into some serious trouble. So it's a practice, and it's a lifelong practice. And like we were saying before, you can put a rubber band on your wrist, you know, or put a ring backwards, or put little, you know, post-its and things like that up so that you can remind yourself to go to God. But in the beginning, it's like throwing with your left hand. So it's a hit or a miss and a hit or a miss. The point is not to beat ourselves up. The point is that we have progress rather than perfection. And some days are great where I'm just so on the mark and I've babysat every single thought. And other days, you know, it's like two or three times in a row. Oh my gosh. You know, got into alcoholism, slipped into it again and slipped into it again. But they say that there's one that has all power and that one is God. May I find him now. Now means right now, means right now, means right now. It never means then. It means now. So the continuous now moment is my porthole to the fourth dimension, or the space where the ego can reside and come back in. And I can ask God to strengthen me in that area. I can say, God, I really am willing to do this, but I don't know how to go the extra mile. Can you help me wake up and start watching my mind? And like I said earlier, to write the most repetitive thoughts out. Now when those ones come in, it's like, oh my God, I have you on paper. Oh, here comes the overweight card, the sugar card, the I hate the driver's card, the whatever it is. And I instantly go, oh my God, I'm catching the mouse in the house. It gets exciting. Look, it's my opportunity to go to God. Yeah, thanks. Is there another question? Back there, Kyle, and then. Okay, please do.
First of all, you're that imperious desire to be bonded to another human being. We call it relationship. I was about a year before I met my wonderful bride, and I'm sitting in a park. It's a beautiful summer day, spring day actually. And, you know, the birds are chasing each other, and the squirrels were chasing. Even the earthworms are doing it, and I was so lonely. You know, and I went to my sponsor, and I whined, of course, and told him how I was feeling with this loneliness. And he just looked at me quizzically and he says, so let me get this straight. You want to walk up to some beautiful young woman and say, hi, my name's Kyle. I'm an emotional bag of shit. You want a date? He suggested that I might like to grow up a little bit first. You know, and I think that's when we really started getting into some real in-depth stuff in the steps. And with 6 and 7, I was very confused. Why do we have two steps that are about the same thing? You know, and as usual, he'd call me an intellectual giant with the common sense of a fence post. And he said, they're not the same. He says, in step 6, you know, you are asking for these defects in your character, those parts of your character that become defective. You're asking for those things to be repaired. He says, when we're talking about our shortcomings, he says, what we're talking about is our inability or unwillingness to do something about those defects of character. He says, the unwillingness is simple. You pray for it. You pray for the willingness. He said, but that inability, that's the tough one. Because if we're unable, it means we don't know what needs to be fixed. So he says, we need to grow up and we need to learn about this. That was really good for him.
Yeah, thanks, Kyle. That's really good. That's such a great example. This young lady back here, you had your hand up? No? Oh, okay. Did somebody else have a question? Over here.
I'm John. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, John.
And I just love, one of my favorites is Chuck Chamberlain. And when he relates to the step, he says, how do you know you no longer have your defects? He says, because I no longer have them. And they're not manifesting in my life. And I just love that.
Thank you so much. Beautiful. Yeah, some of them do just go. They're not there anymore. Thanks so much. Somebody else?
My name is Doug, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Doug.
And I just kind of had a quick story, too, and my sponsor kind of shared the same way with me and simplified 6 and 7 as, like you said, doing what you know you're supposed to do, and 7, not doing what you know you're not supposed to do. And if, you know, and I got that. It made sense to me. And sometimes it's easier than others. And some days are better than others. And there was this one particular day I had gone to Target to go shopping. And it was just one of those kind of days, you know, where I'm really trying to do better. And it's, you know, rebellion dog every step of the way. And I'm pushing the shopping cart out to the car. And he used the example as doing what you know you're supposed to do. You know, put the shopping cart in the shopping cart holder. And I'm pushing the shopping cart out there and I'm thinking, crap. I gotta put it away. Okay, I'm doing this AA thing. I don't want to drink, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, I'm pushing this thing and I'm just irritated going out to this car. And it's like, I gotta put the stupid shopping cart away and, you know, all this kind of stuff. I'm not grateful because I have a vehicle to put groceries in and I'm getting groceries, you know, I'm not there, but it's like, I gotta put this thing away. And so it's like, but are you willing? It's like, you know, yeah, I'm willing. I'm going to regret. I'm going to, resent the whole way over there. And for me, it's like, but I was willing to do it. And what happened was I put the stuff away. I got the shopping cart. And as soon as I turned, this elderly couple walked by me and said, can we take that for you? And nice. I just about burst into tears. You know, they're looking at me like, what the heck, you know? And it's like, you know, all I have to do is be willing and God will step in. And do what I can for myself. And that was just one of those things. Like, okay, I get this.
Right. That's such a great demonstration. I love that. Very nice. Is there over here?
I'm Dave, an alcoholic. This has been a great weekend. I've heard a lot of great things. I've learned a lot of stuff that I'm going to be able to use. For myself and hopefully others. But what I really like is the fact that you took God out of the sky and put him in the basement. And to me, that is about the power comes up through me, metaphorically in the basement, but in here. And that to me is humbly asking God to remove my shortcomings. And the last guy or the guy before him mentioned it. Humility for me is aligning myself with God and becoming a partner. And that's where it comes from within me. And that's when I can be most effective. And that's when things really start clicking for me. I'm pushing a shopping cart and heading out to the shopping cart thing, and two people come up and go, I'll take that off your hands. And it's amazing how things click like that for me in my life when I get myself out of the way. My will, and as you're talking, and we were talking at lunch, and it's like, it sounds so simple. The formula is just so simple and so easy. But and another thing I really valued this weekend is the prayer about God, protect me from my mind, because I overuse mine. And where it takes me is I'm fine. It's the world and all the people in it that are wrong. And so thank you.
Thanks so much. Was there another hand? Somebody want to share anything on 6 and 7? Those are great demonstrations. No. So as I moved into step 8 and I make this list of the people that I've harmed, you know, some of them are on my resentment list and some of them are not, you know. And again, this is an area that I had difficulty in being self-honest. And sometimes in a resentment, I mean, in a harm, I don't even realize how much I've harmed somebody. Like, most people don't tell you how severely you've hurt them until you approach them, you know. People hold back. The way our society is structured is, you know, we sweep things under the rug, or we don't communicate, or we say, it's fine, it's fine, it's fine. And you know, especially in untreated alcoholism with the phenomenon of craving going and then a lot of drinking, there's been a tremendous amount of harm done. So much harm that often the bridges back to safety for family members, some of them are burned permanently. There's just no way back, you know, siblings, aunts, uncles, parents, husbands, wives, children. Some of that stuff can be so severely damaged that even in making a list, people can't seem to get back. And, you know, I think that the street goes both ways when I'm willing to make amends. I think that the amends is first and foremost to free the person from the bondage they had with me. And secondly, if God be willing, free the bondage that I have from that person. And, you know, in 8, I'm just becoming willing. You know, I'm making a list of these people. I haven't done anything yet at all. I'm just writing them down on a piece of paper. And I do believe that it's a lifelong process, you know, and how my sponsor had me do it was just get a 5x7 card or 3x5 card and write down the harm and the person's name and their phone number or their contact information, on the back, like a brief, you know, summary of what I did, you know, how did I affect you? You know, what can I do to set this matter straight? I'm a sober member of AA and I'm here to make amends for the harm I'm consciously aware of. And, you know, that's a really tall order. This is where a lot of people get stuck. I think possibly people even get more stuck here than they do in that fourth step of writing an inventory. This is a really difficult one. And this is where my relationship with God continues to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And in this step, in the 8 and the 9th step, there's no way I can do this without God. I cannot go to my enemies and straighten these things out without a power. There's just self is never, the ego is never, ever, ever going to do it, you know. And I've seen so many things transformed in people's lives. And I've also seen nothing happen. And I've seen people say, get off of my property. You know, the outcome, I don't know. It's very random. I mean, who knows what's going to happen and who knows how much freedom. But it's that I became willing and I, you know, and I went and I, you know, made the amends, you know, and that step, I'd love to hear if somebody have had some really great experiences and outcomes or something where that was just so unforeseen they could have never, ever imagined in their wildest dreams. So if you have a great amends story, I'd love to hear it. Come on up.
There we go.
My name is Liz. Actually, I have a question.
Okay.
I know you're kind of following the big book, definitely. But do you really think it's important that you have to say you're a member of AA?
Well, it says in the print. Thanks for the question. It says in the print that I face these people squarely and I tell them that this is what I'm there to do. So, you know, except when to do so would injure them or others. You know, you take the temperature. If you're feeling like breaking your anonymity might be hurtful, I don't think it has to be etched in stone. I have to tell everybody, you know, what if it's at work and I work for some big corporation and I don't want them to know that I used to drink vodka and stick needles in my arms, then okay, you know, we omit that. So I would say that that's not an absolute, you know, it's just to clean it up and to straighten things out. Anyway, come on up, Kyle, and let us know what your amends was.
It had to do with my first wife. And I've done several amends before. In fact, I had one of the worst ones ever go really bad, and that was a good thing. But I wanted to clear this stuff up with my ex-wife. So when we were married, we had amassed a lot. We had a lot of property, businesses, and all this stuff. And when we divorced, being the wonderful person I am in the middle of my alcoholism, I told the judge she could have everything, and she got everything. So my thinking, and I had specific instructions, you go to her and you tell her, I know I've harmed you physically, emotionally, spiritually, and financially. And I did that. I went and I told her that. But see, the motive back here was, she's going to give me half of everything back because I'm so wonderful now. And she didn't. And I went back to my sponsor and I complained about it. And he asked me, he says, you really expected her to give you half of that back? I said, well, yeah. He says, now you got to go back and do another amend. You got to do the first one correctly. Now you got to go back and tell her what you had done.
Nice.
Yeah. And I did, and I asked her very simply, what do I need to do to make this right in your heart? And that woman put her arms around me and just simply said, just be the man you know your Creator wants you to be. It was
nice.
Beautiful. It was awesome.
Thank you so much. That's beautiful. Does somebody else want to share one of their amends stories with us?
I'm Lorraine. I am an alcoholic.
Hi.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this. A little while ago, I think sometime this morning, you said something about getting our way by fighting through and, you know, trying to arrange everything. Well, I was real serious in step 8 and 9. I mean, I was sincere. I was praying, you know, God, let me make amends. And I had one amends where one of my ex-husbands had died, and I knew I needed to make amends, but I couldn't figure out how, and I kept trying to put something together, and nothing was ever working out, ever. And I just knew in my heart that God would let me know the time and the place. And what happened was I was in Santa Rosa one day, out of the blue. I just get this idea to find the cemetery, and I found it totally guided. And I found his headstone. I didn't know what to do then. You know, I thought maybe like the movies, throw myself down and do all this stuff. But there were guys over there, and I didn't want them to see me. So I'm standing there wondering what God wants me to do, and I looked at the headstone right next to his, and it was his younger brother that had caused huge pain in our family, huge pain. And he had died before he was 21. And I just totally forgave him. I was washed over with forgiveness. And when I went home, I drove home crying all the way. And my sons were there, and they were the ones that were so damaged. And I told them, and they healed, and they forgave because he was so young. Yeah. And he had no time to get a good life. And that was because I quit trying to put it together. I trusted in God, and I was sincere and willing to do whatever God wanted me to do to clean up the hurts of my past.
So beautiful. Thank you so much.
My name's Bridget. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bridget.
Hi. I have this one. I worked for a barber, and I'm a hair designer. And when I was drinking, he wanted us to dress kind of like Hooter girls. And, you know, and I'm just like, oh, I hate him so much, and I'll get back with him. And so he would leave for lunch, and I would, as soon as his taillights would leave, I'd go get us food and then come back. And then when he came back from lunch, I'd take another lunch. You know, so I do two lunches in 2 hours. And when he was gone on Mondays, I would pocket all the money. And I hit my bottom and went and worked somewhere else. And when I did, what I did was took a black marker, one of those permanent markers in my column where all of my appointments were. Through all the years, I took the black marker and wrote, erased or marked off all of the clients and phone numbers. And one of my friends that I was drinking with said, he's going to press charges against you because you defaced his records. And I was like, oh my God, I didn't know it was that bad, you know? And so I ended up opening my own place, and I got sober, and I called to make an amends to him. I didn't even know what I was doing, and just said, you know, hey, George, I'm sorry for what I did. And there was just dead silence. And as I stayed sober a couple years later, it still didn't feel right, because he was really a good man. You know, he took care of my well-being. He knew I was putting myself in dangerous situations and bought tires for my car. And he was like, I was like a daughter to him. And so I ran this by my sponsor, and we did some deep work. And she said, well, so you not only stole money, you stole his time. And you did this. And we came up with an amount of money that I owed him, and reasonable. You know, went back through the years. And so I called him to make an appointment to see if I could talk to him. And I waited in the lobby and read a newspaper, and I was crying as he's cutting, you know, hair. And he was done. And I told him that I had come to make amends to him, that I was wrong for what I had done. And he listened. And I told him that I wanted to pay him back, and came up with a certain amount of money, and I wanted to make monthly payments to him. And he looked at me and he said, so what you're telling me is you finally grew up. He said, that's all we ever wanted for you. And he asked how my mom and dad were, how my daughter was. And my husband and I were in at a conference a couple years ago and he died. And he did hair for 57 years. And I learned all the good stuff that I did, you know, all of my skills from him. And one of my friends brought me his obituary. And it said world's best barber on it. And after he died, his wife became my client. And she said, no one ever cut my hair but George. And I said, well, she said, you're the only one I could think of to come to. So I want to be your client now. And I got to tell her, I said, I learned from the best. And it was just incredible.
So beautiful.
It was.
Yeah. Thanks. You know, my strongest amends is a living amends to my daughter. I left for 3 years and I didn't even see her face from when she was 11, 12, and 13. And that's a huge span of time for a child of that age. I mean, that's a tremendous amount of trauma. And she also knew that her mom was wasted and in the street and in and out of jail. And, you know, I come back and there's a lot of damage and I want to correct it. And going to her and making amends, she was young enough where she couldn't box it out with me and say, you don't know how much that hurt me, you know, and maybe she never will. She's always said, why would I be mad? You finally came back. You know, why would I be upset? And I leave a very open space, though, for her to ever say, you know, now I have abandonment issues, or actually I changed my mind and you have screwed me up. You know, I'm always taking her emotional temperature and talking to her about everything. And, you know, some of the things that I do today is that I'm there for her. Like when the phone rings and she calls, I always pick it up, even if I'm in the middle of a massage with a patient or something. I'm really there for her. And I support her and I care for her, you know, and she took out 4 years of college loans and I've paid off pretty much her entire education, you know, so I was able to like put her through college and she remained in private school even when I was in the street and I came back and I made financial amends for all of that stuff. I paid back the people that paid for her school. I paid for her braces. You know, when I was in the street, I used to shoplift at Trader Joe's. I sent them an anonymous check. You know, I've cleaned and cleaned and cleaned and cleaned up stuff. You know, I've gone to my family and I've told them I'm sorry. And truthfully, even though they say they accept my apology, there's definitely still tension there. And I don't know that it'll ever be fixed. Sometimes I'm in a really surrendered state about it. And other times I'm just like really sad and anxious and angry. And, you know, the thing with my mom is probably still the hardest. It's not an easy road with her. She's very combative and argumentative and she's not warm and she's not fuzzy and cozy. And, you know, I've had people in AA go, you know what, just go and be of service to your mom. It's not about you anymore. It's still such a toxic situation for me that I don't go and be of service and put my head on her chopping board and have her slice and dice me up. Because when I go into that arena, I often can get very triggered and it can take not days, but actually weeks to get it off of me. And I know that this is not in the AA literature, what I'm about to say, but I've had a tremendous amount of relief from it. The abuse and the neglect that I've endured with my mom, I've tried all the imaginable ways with AA to remedy it. And I've made the decision with God to remove myself from my mom. I've caused enough damage and enough harm. And right now in my heart says, I'm not going to any more Christmases, any more Thanksgivings, any more New Year's. I'm done. And that's between me and my God. And I can tell you this, why do I know that's the right thing? Because when I finally made that decision, I could breathe again and I wasn't suffocating on how is this going to happen? Or God, I just wish it would be okay. Or will she ever love me? You know, my mom's a war survivor from Nazi occupied Germany. She's incredibly damaged. She's narcissistic because she had to grow a narcissistic personality. She couldn't be soft. She couldn't be empathetic. She had to struggle for her life. And I can have compassion for that area, but that doesn't mean that I have to continuously put myself in the line of her fire. So making amends and cleaning stuff up doesn't mean that I have to go back in and try to rearrange the dots and create a new relationship, because some things just aren't ever going to be the Brady Bunch, ducky, fluffy, bunny kind of puppy thing. It is what it is. And, you know, because I have a big God, God protects me and God watches over me. And, you know, even all this nonsense of, but it's family. I don't care but what it is, you know, that doesn't mean anything in God's world. Painful situations and abuse and neglect are abuse and neglect. And I don't want to make my mom wrong anymore. It just is what it is. And, you know, I have to live with it the way it is. I don't want to go in there anymore. I go in and I get fired at every single time. My mom never hugs me. She's never told me that I'm beautiful. She has no idea that I'm here. She thinks that AA is for losers. She has a thick German accent. Well, you know, the kind of people you hang around with, hey, I don't even want to have it around me. You know, she's just like that. So she can't see me, and she's never going to see me. I've never been seen by her. I never mattered even when I was little. I would say, I have an ear infection. My ear hurts. And she'd say, come on, get your shoes on. You have to go to school. She never saw me then, and she doesn't see me now. And that's not in the literature. I mean, there's definitely more to go for, and I'm never recommending anyone to throw away a family member. It was a huge decision through a lot of pain for me to completely remove myself from her and say, this is enough. And it's not all bitchy and mean, like, oh, no, I'm never talking to her again. She wouldn't ever call unless I call. She has no desire to really have a relationship with me. Me being a sober member in Alcoholics Anonymous, I really wanted to correct the situation. And self kept saying, we can do it, you know, thinking that God was in there. But nothing was happening. You know, I'd get one step up and two steps back, and I'd go in and hang out with her. And sometimes I'd come out riddled with bullets, and other times I'd come out okay. And, you know, it was such a hit or miss for me that the best choice that I could make was to remove myself from the situation. So, you know, it's not cut and dry, and there's so much to be considered. Each person's interaction and relationship has to be considered very, very carefully. And that's where sponsorship and direction is one thing, but in these areas, to thine own self be true, you know? And like I said before, I've had friends that are like, just go be of service to her. And I'm thinking, wow, you don't see me either. You have no idea how much emotional pain I've suffered, and I still suffer. I cannot just go be of service. I can't demonstrate someplace that I'm not at. It's a very painful situation, you know, and maybe that pain is still the touchstone there for me to the spiritual progress, because I would love to have transcended it and to tell you that it's different, but it's not different. You know, that's who I am in Alcoholics Anonymous. Will my mom ever give me a cake? No. Does she care that I'm sober? I don't think she ever thinks about it one way or the other. I don't think it means anything to her at all. Is my recovery important to her? No. The things that are so important to me, that I value in my life so much, she can't see. She'll never see. I don't want to be in the presence of someone that's so unwilling to look at me, and every time their eyes shine on me, they turn me back into a toad. That's not what God wants for me today in my life. God wants me to rise above, and it was a huge decision, but I can tell you, I've gotten so much relief from actually walking away from my own flesh and blood. That's an amazing thing to say from a podium in Alcoholics Anonymous. This isn't a joke, man. This was something that took a lot of preparation and application and self-seeking and inventorying over and over. So everything isn't like it appears to be, you know, some cut and dry idea, you know, with a sponsor throwing you back into the lion's den. Come on, you know, put on your spiritual boxing gloves, buck up. It's not like that, you know. Does that, somebody else have something they want to share?
Marian, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Marian.
My mother, too, is a war child, survived Nazi Germany. She was born in 1944 in Chemnitz. And, you know, you just told my story. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous 6 years ago. I didn't even recognize the harm that my mother had done. And the other thing that I didn't recognize when I did start to recognize the harm and the damage was I didn't see her. I didn't see her as that little child, that starving little child. But even though I wanted to have empathy and compassion for my mom, and even though I do, you know, the anger still lives in there. And my sponsor told me that that's okay. My sponsor told me that it's all right to walk away. My sponsor said it was okay that I could stay mm-hmm. as long as I needed to. And when I needed to go, I could go. And thank God for that. And you know, we're talking about amends one more time because, you know, I walked around. I didn't speak to my dad for 12 years. 12 years because I pointed at him. And my mom pointed at him, and it was all his fault. And today, I'd like to say that I made amends to my father. We've been able to have a relationship in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, he lives in Florida, and I bought my first house in February this year, and my dad and his wife came out and stripped wallpaper and painted. I mean, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. And it's amazing, amazing grace that I have been able to feel. Anyway, thank you.
Thanks so much. You know, Marian, the process that I went through, I was so, so, so angry, that same kind of anger with my mom. And as I started to make the decision that she couldn't be in my life and I couldn't be in her life anymore, something really unusual started to happen that I couldn't have foreseen. The anger started to turn into grief, and I could not stop crying. I would say for about 4 months, this past inventory, I just cried every single day at every meeting. And I believe what was happening is that even though my mom's not dead, she was really dying. I was really grieving that I've lost my mom, that I'll never have a mom, that I never had a mom. I always raised myself. You know, in some ways, it's like no wonder I was an alcoholic, because the pain that I endured started way before I ever picked up a drink. The rejection and the self-esteem issues and then behavioral problems in school and not fitting in anywhere and never feeling nurtured and loved. You know, when I inventoried this, I came to this realization that I never felt safe anywhere. Like, I never just had this safe, like, bed or nest to lay in where I felt comforted by anybody. Anyone in my whole childhood, that's what the relationship with God has given me. I can close my eyes today and I can dial into a place that feels safer than anything before. But the disruption that was created in early childhood and the trauma throughout my life, it's so hard to see the truth about that because we don't know anything else but that. But as I start to bring my instincts and my will into alignment with God's will, it becomes very clear that no child should ever endure that stuff, that it's just not right, that I can actually use the word, it's bad. It's a bad thing. It's a sad thing. And it's not to make her wrong, like the hatred and the anger is gone, the grief and the sadness that we'll never connect, that, you know, this doesn't come from my ego, but I can tell you that my mom doesn't deserve to have a daughter like me. She just doesn't. You know, she doesn't want any part of me. She can't see me. I haven't lied or cheated or stolen in so long. I work so hard. I make a good living. I don't borrow money. I don't treat people badly. I don't hate. I don't character assassinate. I vibrate at such a higher frequency than the average Joe, and my mom still looks at me and her glasses are broken and bent. She sees somebody and something that's not there. And I'm sure a lot of people can relate to this. These people from our past look at the old character and that's all they remember. There's no amount of demonstration that can fix those goggles. And for me, the best thing was, I'm going this way and you can stay over here. And that pain is the touchstone to a tremendous amount of spiritual progress for me. I never thought that I would be in this position, but I can tell you it's been incredibly freeing. And when I think about Christmas and when I think about Thanksgiving, for the first time in my life, I think, God, I'm going to the Bel Air for Thanksgiving, and I'm going to eat a $140 buffet with my friends on linen and silver. I can't wait. you know? And it's like, I used to think, oh my God, am I going to be invited to Thanksgiving or am I not going to be invited to Thanksgiving? Is there going to be drama? Are they going to get drunk? Am I going to be yelled at? And my whole view of the holidays is so different. I'm going to buy an airline ticket and I'm going to go somewhere for Christmas. So it opened up a whole new realm of possibilities for me. Anyway, I think we're going to take a break for 15 minutes, right? Am I right on schedule? Yeah. And then we'll come back and have, I think, another hour. What do we have here? 3:30. An hour and 15 minutes left. I love the sharing. Please feel free to come up and do some sharing.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.